Hello, my name is Arianis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, we are going to jump into a new topic for our podcast. We are going to jump into pop culture and see how religion impacts one of the most popular shows on television today, Game of Thrones. As a warning for our listeners, we are going to get super spoilery at the end and some deep into some Reddit threads about how the show might end and really down an entirely different rabbit hole than the first part. So the first part of the podcast is going to be just about religion and Game of Thrones and how religion impacts the general mythology of the show. And then at the end, about 15 minutes to go, 10 minutes to go, we're going to jump into some super spoilers. So if you don't want spoilers, I would stop listening then. Also, as a quick programming note, Jason Concepcion, who's our guest for the episode, recently accepted a position at The Ringer, which, when we refer to Grantland as what was the best show on, was the best website on the internet, and we say what was dead is not always dead in Game of Thrones, that is true for the internet as well, because now Jason will be writing for The Ringer. If you haven't checked it out yet, I would definitely go check it out. The people there and the people at Grantland always did my favorite stuff on the internet, so I'm excited to see what they do now at The Ringer. Thanks for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation.
I am joined today by the Maester of Dragons from formerly of Grantland, Woo! Which was, to many of us, the best website on the internet.
R.I.P.
Yeah, that was unfortunately closed down. Jason Concepcion, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is going to be a little bit of a different episode of Multifaithful because we are going to take religion, instead of looking about how it affects people in the world, we're going to actually talk about how it interacts with one of the most popular shows on television, Game of Thrones. And Jason, in his time at Grantland, was the maester, not really only the Maester of Dragons, you were the maester of kind of the entire Game of Thrones universe.
Well, I mean, I did, well, sure, yeah, for in terms of the historiography, the fake historiography of Westeros, yes, I was that guy.
Yeah, and you were also part of the amazing Must Listen to Watch the Thrones podcast.
R.I.P.
Which, R.I.P., R.I.P. I wish it would be back.
You never know.
Never know, never know.
What is dead sometimes rises.
As we know in Game of Thrones, nothing is ever dead for sure.
Right.
And so what we thought we'd do today is maybe run through some of the main religions that are present in Game of Thrones, if they have corollaries or significance with some of the religions we're familiar with today, and then talk about how religion may provide us a window into the future of the show and where it may be going. And so to start, I thought one of the people we didn't see in the last season and who is kind of confusing to many show watchers is Bran.
Yes.
Who is now beyond the wall and learning how to see things through trees.
Yeah.
And his plot line, I think, is generally a little confusing.
Sure.
So I was hoping maybe we could start with the Children of the Forest and the Old Gods and kind of the original religion of Westeros, so the original people of Westeros and how Bran's connected to that, and then maybe work our way forward from there.
The Old Gods are exactly that. They're the OG religion of the Westerosi continent. Pre-human invasion of the continent, the Children of the Forest, which you can think of as kind of like these magical elves, roam the land. We're not sure what they did. We can imagine them fighting with giants. We can imagine them fighting the others. But the first time we really, they enter the historical, the fake historical roles is when the First Men come. And that's when we kind of begin to get an idea of the shape of the Old God religion, which is it's very little symbology. There's no iconography. We don't even know necessarily what it is. But the focus of the religion is on the weirwood trees. And how they tie into kind of the energy of the land. They were described, the Children of the Forest were described as worshiping like the streams and the trees and things like that. So you can think of them as kind of like a very simple animist religion.
Right.
The First Men came, that resulted in warfare for centuries. They cut down the trees, they would kill the Children of the Forest. The Children of the Forest, attempting to keep them from continuing to come in, destroyed the Arm of Dorne, which was at one time a land bridge that connected Westeros to Essos. I guess that, you know, that kept out the dumber ones who just were going to walk, and then anybody who could figure out how to build a boat. Now you've got the more...
And if you look at a map of the world, there's a lot of water there. So a couple of them had figured out boating.
Exactly. They figured out boating by that time. So over the centuries, the First Men pushed the children back towards right at the edge of where the north begins, which is a swampy area called the Neck. And the children basically held them there. This war went on for an untold amount of time until eventually a peace called the Pact was forged in the God's Eye, which is a lake, it's pretty much the center of Westeros. On this island, right in the middle, there's tons of weirwoods. They forge a pact, and then after that, the First Men basically took on the old gods as their own. In terms of what it'd be closest to, it's hard, I guess, I always think of them as kind of like the Viking religions.
Yeah, and there's also definitely a certain parallel to like Native American religions, or because there's a certain connection with the land and a certain spirituality, and also conquer and like almost a colonial. Like there's some of that going on here also.
Right, it's kind of like a great spirit, because you never, there's no, while the trees are the focus of the religion, they don't represent the force behind
it,
which is never really explained. We don't know too much about it.
And so then Bran, in his three-eyed raven, his sight through these trees, is really our only connection right now to someone who's like involved in this. So how is that playing out for the story?
There was a class of, I guess we would call them priests, called Greenseers. These were special members of the Children of the Forest who had a deeper connection, or were capable of a deeper connection with the weirwoods. Bran is one of these, obviously. And so what he's doing is kind of rekindling that ancient part of that religion. What did they do? We're not really sure what they did. we know that the First Men kind of were aware that people could see through trees. That knowledge is kind of seems like it's been lost in quote-unquote current Westerosi politics. But that was a thing that was known. The Andals knew it as well, which is why a lot of the trees got cut down after the First Men. Bran is connecting with the energy of the trees, and also the trees, you gotta understand, they've seen everything that has happened on the continent since, you know, going back to the Long Night, everything that happened beforehand, you know, did they see Bran the Builder raising the wall? They might have, they might have seen that. They've, everything that's happened on the continent that they, that happened near them, we can assume that they have seen. So Bran now has the ability to access all of that.
And then certain gaps in our historical knowledge are possibly filled in through those trees.
What would be left out? Anything that happened in the south post-Andal invasion, there's chances that we might miss some of that because, as I mentioned, like a lot of the trees got cut down, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's pretty exciting to think, wow, we could know about, you know, we could know about the Long Night. We could know if the, you know, ghostly spiders really walked around during the Long Night.
And then what's interesting, and this is going back to a scene from the first season where we see Ned Stark out at one of these trees in Winterfell, and Catelyn, R.I.P. in the show.
Although
books,
she
kind of.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows?
Both.
We'll
both.
Leave, yeah,
both
we can leave
kind
that
of.
Vague. She is, you know, she says, I don't feel comfortable here. And it's clear that, and this is kind of how it opens up, that in the north, the Starks still maintain a lot of this as their religion, which is different from the religion of everywhere south.
So the second major wave of human invasion to the continent was the Andal invasion, and they brought with them the Faith of the Seven, which Martin has talked about as being analogous to Catholicism.
Especially medieval Catholicism.
It speaks of a god that has numerous aspects. The father, the mother, the warrior, the maiden, the smith, the crone, and the stranger.
Should have just stuck with the Holy Trinity. It would have been much simpler.
Right, it would have been easier. And so the Andals came in, and they fought with the First Men, obviously, and much like the Children of the Forest, ended up pushing them back to the north, where the existing bottleneck, number one, mm-hmm. of the neck, kind of kept them from being able to go any further. So, as the story picks up, where we know about it, the north is the stronghold of the old gods, the wildlings. Most of the northern kingdoms worship the old gods, although mm-hmm. there's some interesting...
Right.
The Manderleys, for instance, are southern transplants. They brought with them the faith of the seven.
Right. And also we saw at the wall that they kind of do both when you're taking your vows. Like, we saw Jon Snow do it in front of the old gods, but many others did it with the faith of the seven.
And there's a lot of interesting... religious give and take there. Both religions are respected throughout the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Most castles, for instance, in the south have a godswood that at one time, that either has a weirwood tree or at one time had one,
mm-hmm.
Showing a respect for the old gods. A lot of, like, for instance, when they swear oaths and they'll say, you know, before the old gods and the new, or before gods and men,
mm-hmm.
That saying seems like it descends from kind of the way the First Men would have pledged things in front of the trees. So that seems like, and all descendants say stuff like that. So we can see how the religions have affected each other. But there's generally, as the story is now, there's a respect for both religions.
Which is interesting in the world of Game of Thrones, which is in a lot of ways so troubling and brutal and into death that in the area of our world that so often causes conflict and religion, there's actually, at least among these two, there seems to be this acceptance, pluralism, coexistence. It's not entirely clear.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about because certainly most of the warfare between the Annals and the First Men happened, you know, way, way, way in the past. But even there doesn't seem to be that kind of the undercurrents of religious strife the way we'd think about it now, like where we think about things that have happened in the Middle East, that have political events that have suddenly kind of uncovered these very, very old schisms in the fabric of the culture. That we don't feel that in Game of Thrones. There's not like this hidden old gods, faith of the seven kind of, like, thing that's below the surface. It's just everybody seemed to get along. I don't know if that's he did that on purpose. There doesn't seem to be religion in Game of Thrones. Doesn't seem to take on it doesn't seem to be a medium for culture in the same way that it is in our world.
Right, and this is, it's especially interesting because a lot of fantasy, explicitly or less explicitly, but especially in something like Lord of the Rings, will finish with the hero as a Christ figure dying or being redeemed for the sins of everyone else and the light triumphing over evil.
Right.
And Martin has talked about many times that that's a huge influence on him, and he's trying to avoid going to that trope.
Yeah.
And it seems like one of the ways he's avoided that is the religion or pure, like, the strife doesn't seem to fall so cleanly along religious lines a lot of the time.
Right. He's a counterculture guy. I think a lot of it is, I'm armchair psychoanalyzing now, but I think a lot of it is that he is mistrustful of religion. I think you can see that in the way that he handles prophecy.
Mm.
Like, for instance, second season and in the second book when the Red Comet comes across.
Yeah.
He used that as an interesting device by having various religions comment on it.
Right.
You know, where,
yes,
you know, like,
I remember that.
Whereas, Melisandre would be like, oh, the Red God, obviously, you know, like, or at where, so that, you know, I think he uses religion in an interesting way as a way to strip away bias and show how people can be biased by their religion, I think. But also he can't, it'll be interesting to see how far he can run from these tropes, because
right.
He has introduced the others, which are as close as the story has to a pure evil.
Right. Right, and I think now's a good time to kind of bring up the others. And the others are, as you see them in the show, the White Walkers, or analogous to the White Walkers. And we don't really know much
right.
about their motivation. And in the mythology of the show, that theology is kind of contrasted with the Red God, or R'hllor, as we see, as like this light
yes.
and fire. So maybe to people who aren't as familiar with this, could you kind of unpack that dualism that's going on there?
Well, the books are called A Song of Ice and Fire. So there's this kind of ice and fire theme that runs throughout it. The others obviously come from either cause or come from a part of the natural cycle of the world that results in winter lasting for 70, 80, 100 years.
That uninhabitable cold that they talk about.
Oh, yeah, just a night that lasts forever, people starving to death in their castles, strange animals, you know, walking
mm-hmm.
the earth. Do they cause this, or are they some other part of this cycle? We don't really know that.
Right.
In the East, there's this religion of R'hllor, fire worship, very analogous to Zoroastrianism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is kind of, in the books, they've been a minor religion for
right.
most of the time. But as magic has awakened because of the awakening of the dragons, their power has been growing. It's interesting with R'hllor, and especially Melisandre, it's unclear how much of what she can do is her own power,
right.
and how much of it is some kind of a con game.
Right. Well,
she
even admits to that. She admits to it in a scene where she kind of shows off to, I think it was Stannis' wife,
yep.
her bag of tricks.
Right. And in the books, she does that as well, where there's a couple scenes where she talks about her powders and the different pockets that she has in her vestments. But now we're seeing that there is something behind it
right.
because different members of the religion are able to raise
right.
people from the dead.
Well, that's the reason we know it has to be really important
right.
is because if anyone has seen the Game of Thrones posters for the new season,
yeah.
Jon Snow is obviously still part of the show's mythology.
Right.
And so if he's to be going forward, probably the way that makes most sense that they would resurrect him would involve the Red God, who
yes.
we have seen resurrect people before.
Right.
Which would be particularly interesting because I know as someone who got introduced to everything through the show, the scenes with Stannis and fire very early on were very confusing and
yes.
made almost no sense to
yes.
anyone. And it why did he take this sword of fire out? Like, what was going on with the whole thing? So I feel like that is actually really important because that the sword of fire is almost central to understanding Jon Snow or the Song of Ice and Fire, because that's all wrapped up together.
The Sword of Fire, part of the origin story of Azor. That's it. Let's say okay.
Azor Ahai.
Azor Ahai.
The one who is chosen.
The one
any
who
other
chosen,
million names
right,
that there are.
Is a possibly mythical hero who, depending on which legend you want to believe, ended the Long Night. I guess I should go
he's,
back and say
he's
this.
He's supposed to have said to have this magical sword that was created to be magical with the sacrifice of his wife.
Right, his wife. What happened was he plunged this sword into her chest and drew it out, and it was covered in flame. I should add that this is only one of several
right.
theories of how the Long Night was ended. But this is a legend that a lot of people know about. It's part of it's a central prophecy to
mm-hmm.
Melisandre's particular preachings of the Red God's religion, and she had convinced Stannis that he was that person.
Right.
and had used magic to create this flaming sword.
Which explains
him.
A little bit of why Stannis always seemed to have this faith that he was... Right, even when he was clearly
yes.
in ridiculous positions and was going nowhere,
right. he truly believed
there was
that.
Something in Stannis that pushed his plot line forward to almost an absurd extent.
And she believed it as well, I should add. This is why, going back to like the motivations of the others, this is why it's hard. A lot of people believe that the others somehow won't necessarily be good guys, but there's
right.
going to be some deeper political
right.
motivation to what the others are. They're not, they can't just be pure evil
mm-hmm.
because Martin doesn't do that. So yeah, that's part of if you subscribe to the R'hllor versus others showdown, then Jon Snow could be the prince that was promised slash
right.
Azor Ahai, this legendary figure, returned again with he doesn't have a magical sword yet,
right.
but he could be that person.
Right. And part of what would make that challenging within the narrative of Game of Thrones is that unlike other fantasy like Lord of the Rings, where the hero is very pure and can kind of be redeemed for the sins
right.
of everyone else and has a very Christ-like feature, Martin has talked so many times about how he does not like that trope. And so this Azor Ahai figure, who's like this redeemer of humanity, would also need to be much more complicated
uh-huh.
because the evil he'd be fighting against
right.
can't be purely evil.
Right.
And so what that means for a final battle is actually really unclear. And could partially be why Martin hasn't gotten to the end of writing his books.
That's I believe that to be the case. I think that he's built this incredibly complex world. I think he knows broadly where he wants to go, but I think moving the literally hundreds of pieces
mm-hmm.
Around the chessboard in ways that make sense so that you get there is very difficult. He built this entire world as a way to subvert fantasy tropes,
right?
And to then. Go back to those, I think it's really something he doesn't want to do.
Right.
Although, I mean, when you really look at it, he has subverted the tropes. Has he subverted the tropes, or has he merely buried them under layers and layers and layers of kind of like historical fiction?
Right.
I think that's an argument to be had.
Right.
Because, like, you know, John is an orphan who
right.
has some kind of magical background. He's discovering his power. This is like
right.
all classic stuff.
Right, and the similar plot devices have been used with Daenerys since the beginning of the show.
Exactly.
In fact, hers is in some ways a lot more classic because
much more explicit.
Especially, I actually went back and rewatched the show at the beginning, and I didn't realize the first time how explicitly our first introduction to Daenerys is setting her up as the protagonist of the first season without setting her up as the protagonist,
right.
and it becomes much more obvious once you see that, but as most things do in hindsight. But and her plot line also fits that. But she's also complicated within the religion thing because she doesn't real not much of what she does touches on the major religions. We know that some people, especially within the R'hllor camp, believe in her or
yes.
want her to be the prince that was promised.
Yes.
But we never get any indication from her that it's playing such a role. We just know she has dragons.
Yes, it's interesting. As I guess you can make the argument that as an occupying force in a foreign land, it behooves her to not hew so closely to any one specific religion,
mm-hmm.
Especially you know, in a position like especially where doing so would kind of alienate her from the population she's trying
right.
to control. At the same time, yeah, her family was broadly worshipped the faith of the Seven. Her uncle believed that he was the prince that was promised.
Right.
So it's interesting that she hasn't grasped onto a religion herself, but it makes
right.
sense. When you look at the political landscape that she's
right.
involved in.
I guess we would also say the closest she really came was she really was embracing being Dothraki
right.
at a certain point, which I guess now she's returning to in the new season, so maybe that could actually play a larger role going forward. We don't.
And the Dothraki, they don't know. They're, I guess they have more of an animist religion. They worship a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the thing that they worship is strength.
Right.
Obviously, they're an analog to kind of like these Central Asian
tribes, the Mongol conquest, the Genghis Khan.
Who themselves were very, very malleable.
Right, right. And so I wanted to, talking about religion, touch on two more things.
Sure.
One is the Arya plotline. Because Arya is now blind, or temporarily blind, or as anything in Game of Thrones, who knows.
Right.
But she has been in Braavos, which as a city is the only place we've really been to that represents like this multicultural metropolis
mm-hmm.
that, as we're recording this in New York, would seem familiar to us.
Yes.
And then also the religion, she's, the Faceless Men, is very strange.
Very strange religion. It's, they worship the Faceless God, which they think of as having the aspects of all the religions.
Right.
So there's a scene from inside the House of Black and White from last season where we saw different iconographies from different religions. Like there was a piece of driftwood, so that would represent the religion of the Iron Islanders. We saw either a tree, or so that's the old gods, and we saw some pieces of it was either the warrior or the smith, I forget. So they encompass all the religions, and they see themselves as seeing the true God, which is that there is only really this one force, which is what they worship.
Right.
The faceless God.
Right, and I think their portrayal in the show has been very confusing thus far, and I think deliberately so. I don't think it's an error in showrunning,
right,
as much as to reflect Arya's confusion, we haven't really been given such a good window into what they actually believe.
I mean, it's a good question. I kind of think of them as this kind of like cleansing force that kind of removes. Obviously, as an Assassin's Guild, they're killing people, so who are the people that they are killing? I think that we'll find out more, but I kind of feel like they remove these kind of like impediments to the natural cycle of the world.
Right, which is why they say only death can pay for life.
Right, exactly.
Okay. And then I wanted to also go back to the Faith Militant, because I think one of the, and this is, I know you talked about this on the Watch the Thrones podcast last year, the plot line with the Faith Militant, as portrayed in the shows, was a little bit rushed and didn't really give viewers a complete sense of like who the Faith Militant were and how they went from this nothing to like almost controlling the capital city in three episodes. So maybe we could take a step back and explain to people like, what are the Faith Militant? How did they come about, and how is that part of Martin setting up the politics of Westeros in a way that's sort of resembling like the Pope and and city states and medieval Catholicism and this balance between religion and state nationalism? Like, what's going on there?
The Faith Militant is kind of Martin trying to do the Reformation,
mm-hmm.
Where it goes back to the Targaryen invasion. The Targaryens came in, and a lot of their culture clashed directly with the existing religion.
Right.
For instance, they intermarried amongst their family. This was very troubling.
Mm-hmm.
So it became kind of this a political struggle between who would have the final say of what goes.
Right.
So the Targaryens ended up fighting a low-level war with armed members of the Faith, who talked about themselves as the Faith Militant. They would enforce laws, they would enforce rules of the religion.
Right.
So
very puritanical.
So it became a question of who has the final say in the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
This resulted in warfare for quite a long period of time, until eventually. And so, when people talk about like how did they just take over, we can imagine that there have been strains of this lying in wait
right.
for a while. With dragons out of the picture, it was only a matter of time that this would happen. With wars kind of, with war gripping the entire continent, there's a lot of atrocities going on against members of the faith.
Right.
And so it's only natural they would look around and say, well, who's to protect us? The faith rearmed in order to protect their members, and we kind of see what has happened as the state has given up their monopoly
right.
on power. What do they want? They want kind of a return to a more pure form
right.
of the religion, which they feel has been watered down due to corruption and, you know, the sins of the modern world, et cetera,
right.
et cetera, et cetera.
Especially the sins of the monarchy.
Yes.
Can't say they're too wrong on that one.
They're not wrong at all. So, yeah, it would... How do you get rid of them? Listen, the Targaryens struggled with that question for about 120, 130 years. They had dragons, and they still couldn't fully get rid of them.
Right.
It ended up where they negotiated a settlement where the faith agreed to disband, and they were given certain assurances that they would not their property
mm-hmm.
and would be respected, et cetera, et cetera. It's very much like the Reformation and kind of like the things that led up to the Thirty Years' War.
Right.
What will happen in the future?
Right.
It'll be
the faith is being set up, or the faith militant at least is being set up as a foil a little bit to Cersei specifically,
yes.
but to kind of establish power. How that'll relate, as with anything that's happened in King's Landing since the beginning of the show, how that will relate to the bigger things happening east and north,
right.
I think is still very much in question.
Yes. We can assume that at some point in time, someone's got to go in there and get them out.
Right.
I don't think the Lannisters have the power to do that anymore. They're going to have to make a deal with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the Reach. Would imagine that will be a major plot line for
right.
next season.
So on that note, if you looking ahead and moving to the next season, what are a few if you were to like drop three and this is maybe moving off the religion now, we're
yeah,
just
yeah,
getting
yeah.
into Game of Thrones stuff that I really want to talk about, and podcast listeners who are only into the religion stuff, I'm sorry. But three things that you're looking forward to in the season, or kind of plot lines that you're excited to see develop, and full warning to anyone out there, we're not obeying by any spoiler rules. There will just be, we're just to chat, because there's been a lot of speculation, obviously around Jon Snow, but a lot of the other plot lines, because they've now caught up to the books, there's a certain, actually, like, surprise that may happen this season. Like, they can actually drop something that hasn't been written down, which is new for the show.
Very new. There is still... there is still some material that they can work off of,
right.
Preview chapters and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that have appeared on the internet. It's not much.
Right.
Even the art, like, there's some Arya stuff, I think you could argue that they've gone past it with
mm-hmm.
what they did last season, even the preview chapters. I can't wait to see the Tower of Joy, which
yeah.
is, which is this kind of castle slash keep in Dorne, where
maybe the answer to Jon Snow's parentage lies.
Perhaps the answer to Jon Snow's parentage. What do we know about it? Well, we know that Ned's sister went there. We know that she died there. We know that she was
found by Ned in a pool of blood.
After he had fought through three members of the Kingsguard, why is the Kingsguard guarding a mistress of a Targaryen king? It's a good question.
Right. In the middle of a rebellion happening hundreds of miles to the north.
Roughly 9 months after her abduction by the prince of the Targaryen dynasty. We don't know why those things occurred for sure. What we know is that from the books, she asked Ned to promise her something.
Mm-hmm.
So I cannot wait to see.
Well, the fact that they're putting it on screen this season they've been dropping so many hints. The most obvious was the Baelish and Sansa scene in the Crypts of Winterfell last season. So they've been driving. This has kind of been the big reveal for a long time.
I would argue that they should have been dropping these way
early. Should have been more explicit.
Because I would imagine, like, for show watchers, this must feel like a wait, whoa. Because I wrote about this in my column. When it started, when they did the Baelish thing, and they started to kind of really talk about it, I was like, okay, well, here, let's talk about this.
Right.
Who is Jon's mother really? What do we know?
Right.
And I remember a lot of Just Show watchers were like, whoa. Like,
yeah. Show watcher, like when I started it, it's so obvious in retrospect that the to the like main family who are the protagonists in the first season has a more complicated lineage, right? Like that is every fantasy book ever written.
Yes.
But the fact that you missed that in the show on your first go around, I think is a little bit of either they went out of their way to do that or maybe we just weren't ready for it. We didn't realize how deeply entrenched some of these things would be within the story.
I think that they also, I can understand. Like, there's some prophecy stuff in the books that got left out in various seasons. And I can understand just not being just wanting to stay away from anything that might spoil the story. But at the same time, I feel like they should have. It just feels a little abrupt to all of a sudden come up.
So
that's one thing I'm really excited for. Let's see. Daenerys with the Dothraki. Will this finally move her forward? Will she finally be able to put together some kind of army and will we finally feel as if we're moving towards getting on the ships?
Right, and we've seen these like spurts of inspiration and real leadership from Dany, and then just these 15 episodes at a time, where she's completely bogged down in the minutiae of governance that was really not especially interesting to a lot of people.
And also, what do her followers do with these cities now that she's not there? That's gonna be interesting.
Right. The medieval history of empire building and governance in absentia is mixed at best. So if this is based in kind of a medieval type of context, they could very easily make Dany traveling away the end of Dany's control, or something happens there. In some ways actually just feels like more distraction in her plot line, but I don't know.
Well, we know from the books that that there are armies that gather around around her forces that I think that it seems as if they've cut that plot line out. So it'll be interesting to see.
That's the big battle of Meereen.
The big battle of Meereen. In the show, there's talk of a truce that would take that plot line off the table. So we'll see what they end up doing. It feels like they need something to force her to get on the ship still. I'm interested to see what they do there.
Is it possible that they leave her there and Jon Snow becomes the redemption figure of Westeros?
No, she's got to get on the boats.
Right.
She's got to get on the boats.
The smash the wheel speech was just too good from last
season.
Yeah,
she's
got to
get on the boat. I think, and then the other thing that I'm interested in seeing, and I think a lot of book readers are interested in seeing, is Aegon/Fake Aegon.
Right.
Who for people who, well, now we're in spoiler territory.
Now we're
so,
super
like,
deep.
Listen, if
you're also in
if
like very deep Reddit.
Yeah,
territory
right. Like
right
if you're
now.
Still if you're still listening to this and you haven't read the books, get out. He is ostensibly the other last member of the Targaryen dynasty who has been kind of raised very secretly by
Varys Varys's network,
right? Varys's deep network of Targaryen sympathizers that went underground after Robert's rebellion. In other words, one of the children who was killed by the mountain, smashed. Right. The boy was smashed. Mm-hmm. His brains were smashed against the wall. Actually survived.
Right. He or there. Varys substituted the baby.
Right. Is that true? Do you believe that? I don't know. But in the books, a boy of about 16 years who, so the, you know, of the age works, and he's got the hair and he's got the look, has been raised by Varys' network, lands on Westeros somewhat in a rush, and they begin to take castles. Is he the real article? I don't know. I personally say no.
Interesting.
But it'll be...
Well, they're for sure introducing that plot line in the coming season.
I don't know. So it'll be interesting to see what they do to kind of like ratchet up the pressure on not only Daenerys, but on the Lannisters.
Right.
Because you would imagine that if a prince claiming to be the final Targaryen mm-hmm. prince lands on Westeros and takes a castle that is said to be untakeable.
Stealing some of Danny's thunder right there.
Right. That would cause panic on a lot of fronts.
Right.
And also, like, I hope they do something with that plot line, because Dorne was kind of done in a rushed way last
so
year.
So rushed.
Where you kind of didn't... You never felt that... in the books... Dorne seems to be weak, but in reality they have been working tirelessly behind the scenes at bringing down the Lannisters in various ways.
It's called the Grand Dornish theory, or the Grand Dornish conspiracy.
Yeah, it's because they don't have the armies that these other constituent kingdoms do. They have to kind of like. They have to kind of work by soft power, which kind of makes sense for them. They're poisoners.
Mm-hmm.
But in the show, you never get that. You don't get that. Prince Dorne is like...
They made him seem very weak in the show.
Right, which, in the books, he appears weak, but he is doing that because he's hiding all these different things that he's involved with. In the show, he's straight up probably is just weak.
Right, and this is relevant because the way some people conceive of this plotline is he has a vested interest in Fagon.
As he should.
Right.
It
was his daughter.
Right. So that's... I'd say those are the biggest ones. Obviously, there's so much.
Right. And whenever they get rid of the Boltons, hopefully will be obviously that'll be the one redemptive part of entire Game of Thrones.
John, I've like everyone else, you're kind of like a victim of the internet's ability to spoil things.
Right.
But I like, you know, John, now that he has died,
freed from his vows,
that feels like kind of a cheat to me. But yeah, but like, hey. Now he can, reconstitute the Stark kingdom.
Right. He also happens to have an army that he just let through the gates that don't really like anyone but him.
Right.
Just happens to work out really nicely.
It's kind of great. And the Boltons are widely disliked throughout the North.
They're probably the closest thing we have to the others, actually, as a pure evil in the show.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they have a long history with the Starks. Of warring with them
mm-hmm.
over thousands of years, sometimes sacking Winterfell. They've sacked Winterfell probably like two or three times.
Right.
A question I got back in the Grantland days a lot was like, why did the Starks put up with this from the Boltons?
Right.
It's like, well, you know, okay, they sacked Winterfell like 2,000 years ago, three times, but you know, if they've been kind of chilling for the last 2,000 years, it's kind of
maybe the habit's been broken.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to just be like, all right, we got to take these guys out.
Right.
And also, one thing that I think the books do really well, and the show does really well also, but not quite as well, is give you a sense of how expensive war is in this milieu. You know, if you're going to start a war, you've got to call in your banners. They've got to call in their people. Most of these armies are made up of peasants who should be working the fields. Now they're carrying spears.
Right.
They're away from home. Your entire economy grinds to a halt.
Yeah,
nothing is getting done. Bandits can come in and, you know, raid your lands.
Right. while Theon Greyjoy can come in and sack your castle while no one's there anyway.
Exactly. And so it's very, very expensive. So if, let's say you conquer it, let's say you you force the Boltons off your lands and you conquer them, and you're looking at a 3-4 year siege if you really want to reduce them to nothing. You know, if they go, hey, listen, you can have this parcel of land here. We'll give up the, you know, a couple lands along the river. Promise, we're never going to do this again. That's pretty much the best you can hope for in a lot of situations in Westeros. So that's what the Starks are looking at.
Well, it'll be interesting. I'm excited for the new season.
as am I.
And thank you so much for joining us. Well, and I hope that for anyone who just listened to the last 20 minutes of this, we didn't spoil too much. Nothing we said is in the deep subreddit, Reddit, or just plain YouTube videos of Game of Thrones if you look for them. But
I hope you get to watch it as the premiere is on the Seder this year.
Yeah, it's gonna be really rough. I'm gonna be with my fiance and my parents, and Game of Thrones will be, I think, airing during the Seders, and it's gonna be the most conflict I've had during the Seders since the UConn men's basketball team won their championship and played during the Seders, and I tried to convince my dad to let me keep the game on, which he did not. So I will be turning on my phone, computer, and all technology after the holiday is over, and first things first, we'll be watching Game of Thrones and then checking work email. So if anyone tried to get in touch with me over those 2 days, also, apologies, Game of Thrones was on. But Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. We'd especially like to thank our guests, the Maester of Dragons, Jason Concepcion, for spending so much time with us and getting so deep into some fun Game of Thrones theology and trivia. Special thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast, and to Luis Suados, whose music is originally from the Of Many film. We hope you liked this slight deviation from our normal style of the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please shoot us an email at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and we hope you come back to listen next week.